Okay, I want to welcome everybody this morning to the 2009 Cognitive Neuroscience Annual Spring Retreat in the afternoon, the Kavli Institute for Brain and Mind Symposium. Before we begin the spring retreat, I want to make a brief announcement that we're very pleased that this year's 2009 Francis Crick Nobel Lecture will be given by Horace Barlow, very appropriate for this symposium on vision. He will be giving that here at the Salk Institute on May 15th, that's a Friday at 4 p.m. We hope that many of you can come to that lecture. So the Cognitive Neuroscience Training Grant, which is sponsored by the National Institute of Mental Health, provides us with four graduate slots and four postgraduate slots. And we're very pleased that we'll be hearing from all of our trainees later this morning. But first, we have a symposium on cognitive vision, and we have three very distinguished speakers. And the first speaker, Tom Albright, was just inducted last week into the National Academy of Sciences. So we're very pleased that he'll be able to give us the first talk. I'm told that the security was so tight at the talk that was given by President Obama that they would not let his son Anthony into the room.
That's true. I begged everybody, they wouldn't let him in.
So, Tom's talk will be on the adapting to the environmental changes, lessons from color opponent system. Tom.
Thanks, Terry. Am I on with this?
Okay. Sensory systems are optimized to maximize gain of information, and one common form of this optimization involves allocation of sensory resources to stimuli that are frequently encountered in the world, because those are the stimuli that are most likely to be of behavioral significance. And this simple point is illustrated graphically in the next couple of slides. Imagine this is a distribution of values along some hypothetical, does this work here? Along values along some hypothetical sensory distribution. We'll call X. Now imagine we have a detector for different values of X. Under optimal conditions, you'd want the dynamic range of those values to be centered on the distribution of stimuli in the world. And there are lots of documented, this is intuitively obvious, and lots of documented examples of this kind of thing in the natural world. And it naturally follows that if the world changes, if rare stimuli become more frequent, and vice versa, there ought to be a corresponding shift in the allocation of sensory resources such that the dynamic range becomes centered on the new environment. And that change ought to persist, that reallocation ought to persist, with an intransience that matches the duration of the change in the environment. Now, we call this type of change long-term sensory plasticity. This is an adaptive compensatory mechanism that serves to calibrate sensitivity throughout life. And I want to stress that this is not simply a developmental phenomenon. This continues throughout the duration of life. And it's based on the average statistics of the sensory input. Now, there are lots of forms of long-term sensory plasticity that have and can and have been studied. But one of the most promising model systems for looking at this type of plasticity is the red-green color opponent mechanism in the primate visual system. And before I tell you about our experiments in which we manipulate the system, I want to give you a brief refresher on the concept of color opponency. The story begins in the middle of the 19th century with these two gentlemen. This is Hermann von Helmholtz and this is Evel Hering. Helmholtz and Hering had many common interests, and they disagreed on many things, and perhaps most famously on the topic of color vision. Hering was an advocate of the so-called trichromatic theory of color vision. This is a theory that was developed originally by Thomas Young about 50 years before Helmholtz came on the scene. And it's the theory that you're all familiar with, the concept of three separate receptor types, and any perceived color in the visible spectrum can be accounted for by the relative activations of those three different receptor subtypes. Hering developed, by contrast, the opponent process theory, and there are a number of ways in which this theory is distinguished from the trichromatic theory, and I just want to focus on a couple of them because they're relevant to the plasticity experiments I'll tell you about. The first is illustrated here. Hering acknowledged the primacy of the color yellow, unlike the trichromatic theory, and what I mean by that is he termed yellow to be a unique hue. This was actually acknowledged by many people long before Herring came on the scene, but Herring incorporated this into his theory. And what that means is that the phenomenal experience of the color yellow is that it is not a combination of any other colors. That is, when I see this color yellow, it's not a combination of red and green. It is something unique, and it has the same status in that respect as the colors red, green, and blue. The other important feature of Herring's theory is the concept of opponency. Opponency derives in part from the fact that lights that have combinations of red and green are not perceived as having combinations of red and green. That is to say, there is no such thing as a reddish green or a greenish red, and likewise, there's no such thing as a bluish yellow or a yellowish blue. What we have is a point of equilibrium, which is related to the concept of opponency. Equilibrium is the point at which a light has equivalent amounts of both green and red, and under those conditions, lights will only be perceived to vary along the opponent axis, that is the blue-yellow axis. And likewise, for this axis, if we have equivalent amounts of yellow and blue in a light, you'll only perceive those lights to vary on the red-green axis. Now, this debate between, we now know that both of these theories are correct, but the debate between Herring and Helmholtz raged on through the latter half of the 19th century, both between the principals and between their students. And Helmholtz effectively won the debate in the 19th century in large part because he was more deeply entrenched in the scientific establishment of the day. And by the turn of the 20th century, Herring's opponent process theory was largely neglected and languished for several decades until these two people came on the scene. This is Leo Herbitsch and Dorothea Jameson. Leo Herbitsch, by the way, one of the great vision scientists of the 20th century, died a week ago at age 98. Herbitsch and Jameson did a pioneering series of studies in the mid-1950s, which really nailed down Herring's opponent process theory. I'm not going to go into the details of their experiments, but they provided a quantitative substantiation of the opponent process theory, which led naturally to the question of where in the brain we have color opponent mechanisms. And that question was addressed early on by this gentleman here. This is Russ Dieveloy, who did pioneering experiments again in the late 1950s, way ahead of his time. This is an illustration of a color opponent cell. I'm not going to go into the details of these data. I'm going to show you a cartoon in a second. But this is a demonstration of color opponency from a single cell in the lateral geniculate nucleus of the thalamus. Now, how do these color opponent neurons work? Well, they receive inputs from two different cone types. This is a cartoon of a red-green color opponent neuron. It's getting input from long wavelength sensitive and mid wavelength sensitive cones, but these inputs are of opposite sign. And we can record activity from these cells, as Dieveloy did in the 1950s, and many people have done subsequently, and we find that they have a baseline firing rate. And what I've plotted on the upper right is the response functions, both for the cones themselves, either the cone fundamentals indicated in the red and red and green, and the response function for the color opponent neuron, which is indicated in black. And this is simply the difference between the two cone response functions. The case I've drawn here is one where it's excited by red and inhibited by green, but you can have the opposite type as well. And what I've illustrated here is excited by red and inhibited by green. And surely enough, if you present a red light, you'll get an excitatory response from the cell, and if you present a green light, you'll get an inhibitory response from the cell. And now we can tie this back to Herring's concept of color opponency by noting that the system is at equilibrium at this zero crossing here. What this means is that we presented the cell with a mixture of red and green lights, or something equivalent to a mixture of red and green lights, that causes the cell to, the net output of the cell to be zero or equal to its baseline firing rate. And the cell is thus ideally situated to detect deviations from that point of equilibrium. Now, tying this back to the earlier point about optimal encoding of visual information, we can note that the dynamic range of this cell, which is sort of highlighted by this faint blue line here, is centered, or should be centered, according to this optimality theory, should be centered on the average chromaticity of the environment, so that it's at equilibrium at that average point, and the system is thus ideally designed to detect deviations from that average, the average being the, for the environment that we evolved in, the average being the average chromaticity of sunlight and the stuff that's in our environment that sunlight is reflected off of. Now, this then puts us in a position to test the hypothesis of long-term sensory plasticity, because we can, well, first we'll develop an axiom, which is that optimal performance of this color opponent system is defined by its ability to detect lights that deviate from the space-time average chromaticity of the environment. Okay, we'll take that as a given. This is the way the system ought to be set up if it's to perform optimally. And then we develop two hypotheses from that axiom. First of all, the system seeks optimality by balancing the L versus the M cone inputs such that the average output of the cone opponent system is equal to its baseline firing rate. So it's going to try, according to this hypothesis, to come to this stable state under the average chromaticity in the environment. And secondly, extended environmental change initiates a reoptimization. And so we have here, we can highlight, I apologize if that's hard to read, we have here, this is our manipulation. Our independent variable right here is extended environmental change, and our dependent variable will be the balance of the L versus M cone inputs to these cone opponent neurons. Now we can measure the L versus M cone neurons quite simply, and I'll tell you how we do that in a second, but this is just an illustration of the manipulation of the chromaticity of the environment. So these are experiments that were done with rhesus monkeys as subjects. They're sort of an ideal model for the human visual system. This is the average sort of the control condition. This is the condition in which the monkey lives in broadband fluorescent lighting in the animal housing room here at the Salk Institute. And we can put the animal in two different, narrowband illumination conditions. This is a narrowband green light room. This is a gelatin dye, narrowband gelatin dye filter placed above a whole bank of 400 watt incandescent bulbs. So it's a very greenish room. And the monkey lived in there for a while. And then the monkey lived in a reddish room, again generated by putting a gelatin dye filter in front of the bank of lights. And this illustrates what we predict will happen for the color opponent neuron. So here's again our color opponent neuron. This is a control condition. This is how the cell ought to behave under the average conditions in the environment that the animal has lived in for years. Okay, we have a balance of the red-green cone inputs, so the cell is at equilibrium at this point right here. Now let's suppose we put the animal in the green room, and the prediction is that we ought to be hyperactivating the M photoreceptors, and that should lead to a compensatory decrease in the weight of this input onto the cone opponent neuron. And we can, another way of saying that is we simply reduce the relative gain of the M cone input relative to the L cone input, and the consequence of that is a shift of the zero crossing to the green side of the spectrum there, to the left. And then we can do the same experiment in the red room, and again, the prediction is there ought to be hyperactivity of the L photoreceptor, a compensatory decrease in the weight of that cell's input to the color opponent neuron, and that's represented here by a relative decrease in the gain of the L cone input, and the consequence is a rightward shift of the zero crossing towards the red side of the spectrum. So these are our predictions about how the weights of these photoreceptor inputs onto the color opponent neurons ought to change as a consequence of long-term housing in these different chromatic environments. So this is an illustration of the different illumination conditions that we used in the experiments. These are just the spectral power distributions. Plotted on top of each one of these are the cone fundamentals for the L, normalized cone fundamentals for the L and M cones. This is the spectral power distribution in gray for the white broadband fluorescent lighting. This is the power distribution for the green filter, and that's for the red filter. And what we want to estimate is the average cone excitations under these three different environments, because that's going to lead to our hypothesis about cone waves. Now, in practice, it's a very difficult thing to do to estimate average cone excitations, because it depends upon lots of factors other than the illuminant, like the reflectance of surfaces in the environment, the things you happen to look at, and so forth. But we can make a first-order estimate by simply taking the product of the spectral power distribution and each one of the cone fundamentals, and that's what we've done. And that's plotted in the center panel here. This is a contrast measure, cone excitation contrast. The horizontal line here is the point at which the inputs, the excitation of the two cones should be equal to one another. And this is 100% L-cone excitation, 100% M-cone excitation. And as you, as intuition would suggest, as we go from the green room to the white room to the red room, there is a progressive increase in relative L-cone activation relative to M-cone activation. Now, you might be asking yourself, well, why are these not distributed around the equal point here? And there's a sort of a trivial explanation for this, which has to do with differential photon absorption by the ocular media, which I'm happy to address later on. But I just want to assert that it's the relative contrast that really matter, not the absolute values. Okay, so those are our estimates of average cone excitations for the three rooms. And our prediction is there ought to be a compensatory decrease in the weights from those cones onto the color opponent neuron that's equal and opposite. So we just take the additive inverse of these values, and that's what I plotted over here. These are the cone predicted cone weight contrasts following the three different environmental conditions. And I think the next slide is this illustrates the way we actually collect the cone weight data. This is following a method that was developed in collaboration with E.J. Chichilnitsky a few years ago. It doesn't really show up very well on this screen, but this is an array. This is a movie, a dynamic chromatic noise movie that we show to the receptive field of the cell that we're recording from. And this illustrates a single frame of the movie. It's made up of 64 square pixels. They're a quarter of a degree on a side, so the whole thing is 2 by 2 degrees. Each pixel, the color of each pixel is drawn randomly from a predetermined distribution over space and over time. These frames are occurring every 10 milliseconds, so there's 100 frames a second. And we present them repeatedly to the cell, and this just illustrates what it looks like, sort of. I don't know if this movie will work, but oh, there we go. It's sort of a crude version of what the monkey actually sees. So it's just spatiotemporal chromatic noise.
You need a better monitor.
You need a better monitor, yeah. That's an old style monitor, right there. Okay, so we then use a method of reverse correlation to analyze the data. So you can think of these frames of the movie as being stacked up over time. And we're also collecting action potentials from single cells. I should say these are isolated cells in area V1, primary visual cortex of rhesus monkeys that are alert and fixating during stimulus presentation. So every time there's an occurrence of a spike, we look back in time and identify a frame of the movie. And the assumption is that there's a causal relationship between the occurrence of these frames of the movie and the occurrence of these spikes. And so this goes on for a long period of time while the monkey is fixating, and there may be tens of thousands of frames of these movies. And again, the assumption is that there's something about those frames that are identified in this way that's common to all those frames. And so here's a bunch of them. We call these spike trigger stimuli. And if you look at these, you say, well, there's nothing obvious that's in common between these different frames. But if you just simply average those frames together, you get something like this, which is what we call the spike-triggered average stimulus. And what this is a demonstration of the color selectivity of a single cell in primary visual cortex. This is a cell that's excited by red light. And I'll show you in a second, it's also inhibited by green light. And the receptive field is very small. This is 2 degrees, so it's it's close to a half a degree on a side. This is a cone opponent neuron. Now, I didn't tell you about this, but the colors we used in this stimulus were such that they're so-called cone isolating stimuli. And so we can, given that that's true, we can go back and deconstruct the spike-triggered averages individually for the three cone types. This is a spike-triggered average stimulus for the L cone, that's the M cone, that's the S cone. And you can see that the cell is, and bright means excitation, black means inhibition. The cell is excited by long wavelength photons, is inhibited by mid wavelength photons, and it's very, very slightly inhibited by short wavelength photons. And the way we calculate the cone weights is by identifying the pixels in this array that are maximally driven or maximally capable of driving a cell, I should say. And this, the intensity is simply the measure of cone weight that we use in our sample. Now, so this is what we apply to every cell we encounter in area V1. And this is sort of a broad view of the experimental design. So the animal's been living in this broadband fluorescent lighting for years. We then record from, at the outset, a bunch of neurons in primary visual cortex. We then put the animal in the red room for a minimum of 2 weeks, and he stays in there for up to 8 weeks. And then we record some more neurons, and we put the animal in the green room, and then record from some more neurons. And so you can see that this is a population analysis. The ideal experiment, of course, would be to record from a single neuron the whole time while we're going through this, but for obvious technical reasons, that's impossible. So what we have to do is look at the distribution of cone weights in this sample and compare them to that sample and that sample, and that's what's done in the next couple of slides. Again, this is an illustration of the power distributions of the three lighting conditions and, again, the cone fundamentals. And the middle panel are the empirically determined cone weights for a sample of color opponent neurons in area V1 following each of the three housing conditions. So we'll start up here. This is the green room, it's white room, red room, and you can see that the difference between the L and M cone activations increases substantially as we go from green to white to red. Okay? Now, what we calculate on the right here, again, this is a prediction. This is a cone weight contrast measure. It's just a ratio of the weights for the two different housing conditions. But these are the predictions based on the illumination conditions. And now I'm going to show you the observed values, which were calculated from these cone weights. And they're indicated right there. And you can see, first off, the ordinal relationship between these observed cone weight values is exactly what we predicted. And moreover, there's actually a close quantitative relationship, at least for the green and white rooms. The red room, the observed values undershoot the predictions considerably, and I have some ideas about why that might be true, which I'd be happy to talk about later. But in general, there's a pretty good agreement with the predictions, and I should say that this difference here between the green and red room is highly significant. Neither was significantly different from the white room, and that's, we think, just has to do with the fact that the sample size is not sufficiently large to get statistical power. Okay, so those are the observations which match our predictions, and they're plotted, replotted again here. Now, it turns out that there was a study, a human psychophysical study that was done a few years ago by Jay Neitz and colleagues, which is I've taken their published data and replotted them in the form that I used for our monkey data, and you can see here are the predicted values. They didn't record from V1 in people. What they did was they used a psychophysical measure of equilibrium that enables them to estimate cone weights in people. And the point simply is that the predicted values match the observed values in their case, and moreover, they match pretty closely what we see in rhesus monkeys.
Did they force them to live in a red room?
More or less. They gave them red goggles. They did it two different ways. They red goggles in one case and red illuminant in another case. For 4 hours a day, I think it was. Our animals, I should have said, lived in this environment for 12 hours a day. They were on a 12-hour, they are routinely on a 12-hour day-night cycle, light-dark cycle, and that daylight was always red while they were in the room. Okay, so I've told you about these cone opponent neurons so far, but it also happens that we were recording from another class of cells at the same time, simply because we encounter these along the way. And these are what we call cone non-opponent neurons, or they're sometimes referred to as luminance neurons. And they differ from the cone opponent neurons mainly by virtue of the fact that the cells are getting excitatory, or they're getting the same sign of input from all cone types. So this cell is excited by L, excited by M, and excited by S. And so we can ask, well, are these variations in cone weights that are a consequence of the environmental conditions selective for this class of cells, or do they also carry over to the luminous cells? And so that's what's shown in the next slide. Here, this is just a reproduction of the data for the color opponent neurons I showed you a moment ago. And again, the difference between the L and M cone weights increases as we go from green to white to red. These are the cone weights measured empirically for the luminance neurons. And again, these were collected from the same monkeys more or less at the same time as we were collecting these data. And you can see as we go from the green to the white to the red room, there's essentially no change. It's sort of hard to tell, but you'll see it more clearly when I plot the ratios on the right here. This, again, the big blocks here are the predictions based on the illuminant that I described earlier. The little black lines are the empirically determined cone weights for the color opponent neurons. And here, the blue lines indicate the cone weight contrast for the luminance neurons. And you can see that it's pretty much flat across the different environmental conditions. So the point is that the cone weights are changing considerably for these environmental conditions, but not changing at all, for this class of cells, but not changing at all for this class of cells. And, well, why should that be true? Let's take a briefly address that question. This is, again, an illustration of the cone fundamentals and the response function for a color opponent neuron. And the key thing about this is that is the zero crossing. So if I vary, as I've shown you, if I vary the relative strength of the inputs from the L&M cones, that zero crossing shifts to the left and the right. And by virtue of that, I'm shifting the dynamic range of the cell across the spectrum. If I vary the relative weights of the cone inputs to the luminous neuron here, this is the sum of them, because that's what the luminous neuron does, it adds them up. If I vary the relative weights, those relative variations are lost in the summation of the inputs onto the cell. So it has essentially there's no functional benefit to changing the relative weights of the cone inputs onto the luminous neurons, as there is in the case of the color opponent neurons. Now, what about mechanism? Well, the truth is we don't know anything about how this actually happens or where it happens, or we know very little, I should say. But we can imagine that this is a form of homeostasis. So what the system wants to do in order to behave optimally is to reduce its output so the output equals the baseline firing rate under the average environmental conditions. And so if the output is chronically driven high or low, the system ought to have some way of adjusting the synaptic weights from its inputs, from the two cone types, in order to bring that back down to the baseline firing level. So some form of mechanism that takes that into account must be what's underlying this. So just a quick summary. Red-green color opponent system seeks optimality by dynamically balancing the L versus M cone inputs to V1 neurons. This is an experience-dependent adjustment of these cone weights, and it is selective, highly selective, for this particular class of neurons, which makes good functional sense. And finally, I didn't really talk much about this, but the physiological measures that we've made correspond well to psychophysical measures by Jay Neitz and colleagues, and also there's a recent paper from Steve Chevelle's lab, which documents essentially the same form of psychophysical effect, which corresponds to our neuronal effect. Now, one final thing, you're thinking, well, these red and green rooms are pretty extreme conditions, and you know, we don't normally put ourselves in those kinds of environments. So is this really relevant to normal environmental changes? And so here's three examples of naturally occurring conditions for which color vision might be optimized by adjustment of cone weights. The first are biases that are genetically or disease-induced. For example, this is astounding, but it's known that there's a 10 to 20-fold variation in the ratio of L to M cones. These are just pictures. These are red cones, green cones, across the normal population. So you might have a 1-to-1 ratio, and I might have a 10-to-1 ratio of these things. And so how is that compensated for so that we see the same colors when we wander around the world? Well, one possibility is that this flexibility in the system, the ability to adjust the cone weights, is compensating for that variation in the photoreceptor values. Age-related changes in ocular media. As you get older, the photons that would normally activate the short and mid-wavelength photoreceptors get increasingly absorbed by the lens and the ocular media relative to long wavelength photons. And so this may be a way of compensating for those progressive changes across the course of your lifetime. And finally, biases in the physical properties of the environment. The average chromaticity of these two environments is quite different, and it may be that when you shift from one environment to the other like this, this is a system that enables you to compensate in order to adjust your system optimally for the new environment. And finally, I just want to acknowledge the people who were involved in this. The person who did all the work I talked to you about today is this guy right here, Posna, who's in the audience. Posna, where is Posna? There's Posna right there. Posna did everything. I just talk about it. And my technician, Dindip, was instrumental in all this. And a lot of techniques were involved. Work that was developed by Greg Horwitz, who was a postdoc in my lab now at the University of Washington. And I should have put EJ up here. This was inspired originally by a collaboration with EJ. Thanks.
Where in the brain or the retina do you think this is taking place?
Yeah, so given the experiments I described, there's not a lot I can say about it, but the Neitz experiment demonstrated interocular transfer. So they adapted people with one eye, and then did the test. This is a psychophysical measure. It's just you twiddle a dial until you find the wavelength that you describe to be uniquely yellow. And you ask people to do this, and they're bang on day after day after day. The same wavelength is unique yellow, and it's consistent across the population. But it transfers. You expose them to red light, and that effect then transfers to the other eye. And that would suggest that it's implemented at least at the level of striate cortex, because that's the first point at which you get mixing of information from the two eyes.
Okay, one last question from Irv Biederman, who's visiting from USC.
Just a brief one, maybe it's a little irrelevant. Is there less orientation tuning for these color opponent cells than the luminance cells?
That's a good question. Posner might be able to comment on that more than I can. So it's less common, the orientation selectivity. There are many of these color opponent cells. I should have said that. The one example I showed you was not orientation selective, but there are many that are orientation selective. But there is a tendency for them to be less orientation selective across the population.
Do you want to add to that?
Go ahead.
No, I said they're less orientation selective.
Okay.